Now, TalkZone presents Money at Work, the weekly show that addresses the issues of the day from a financial perspective. Now, here are your hosts, Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
Good afternoon. It is Thursday, yet again, August 7th. It's Money at Work Radio we're listening to here. My name's Steve Memory. Brian Bourdon, unfortunately, can't be with us. He's off in Michigan right now. But we have the intrepid Lily Poy with us. Hi, Lil. How are you doing?
Hi, Steve. How are you? Thanks for having me again.
Glad to have you here, Lily. Just so everybody knows, if you'd like to get in touch with us, feel free to go ahead and give us a call. We have an 800 number. It's 855-691-8800. You can also reach us at mail@moneyatworkradio.com. Or you can go ahead and stop by, take a look at us on the web. We're at www.ovcapital.net. As they mentioned, this is Money at Work Radio. We take a look at a lot of the news out there from a financial perspective, give you a couple of ideas on what's going on individually with some stocks. But right now, we got a lot to talk about. We have a lot of different things going on in the world, a lot of different things going on in the marketplace. So as we were talking earlier, Lily, about some of the good news that's out there, we had some wrap-ups on the earnings that are coming out. We've had about 75% of the S&P 500 finished up reporting by the end of last month at July 31st. Looked like we had second quarter EPS gains coming in close to 9%, I guess.
Yeah, they all look pretty good.
Yeah, yeah, about 2.5 percentage points higher than we expected. So that's a nice thing. We had revenue for the 500 largest companies there, tracking to about 4.3% over last year's second quarter. So that's a nice gain. So when we're looking for the economy to do something, a nice place to go ahead and start is with corporate earnings. Actually, that's interestingly enough, that's the biggest gain we've seen since the first quarter of 2012. It doesn't seem like that long ago we were at 2012, does it?
Well, just looking at, you know, the corporations are profitable, don't you think? I mean, well, I know at the beginning they were doing, you know, stock buyback and all that stuff, laying off, cutting cost. But now, you know, we want to see revenue rising from sales.
Well, that's the big thing. Yeah. And we're seeing revenue increase, not just earnings, but actual revenue. And that means we have people going out there and buying stuff, and that companies are going ahead and seeing that trickle down to earnings per share. We have profits up about 7.7% in the quarter, and that's the fastest growth for profits since the fourth quarter 2013, when we had a big move. We're looking for growth in the third and fourth quarter here coming up at about 4.3%. That, according to Thomson Reuters, that's generally what the economists are out there hoping to go ahead and do. But we're likely to go ahead and see earnings and earnings per share increase throughout the remainder of the year, even with revenue staying the way they were, because there's a lot of cash out there still, and there's plenty of capital spending that could occur that really hasn't been done. So here's the interesting thing now. We've got earnings and revenue being pretty darn positive. We see some significant moves forward in earnings, and yet the market is down. How about that? Well, what do you think?
I know the market is down, but not the global market, right? So money has to go from one place to another. Sometimes, you know, they'll probably sit in cash, but I think this time, you know, I actually see money flow going into emerging markets.
Yeah, I've seen a bit of a transition there. I guess the valuations are a question for a lot of folks. Two ways for us to go ahead and move forward on higher, with higher stock prices. One, of course, is, where we are right now with a lot of, free money flowing around because of the low interest rates. And, the other is that we significantly boost earnings. Well, we're starting to get the earnings to move up, and that should go ahead and give us the catalyst for moving forward. We're down, I guess, about, what, 3% or so? No, 3.25%, I guess, for the past month. Down about 2% or so for August here thus far. which isn't a huge move. I mean, it's within, it's not even what we would call a correction at this point in time. But the
and
fact
all,
that we are seeing,
it happened with just a couple of days. You know, you have a couple of days of, pretty big, downward movement.
You can get into a situation where there's some self-fulfilling prophecies. You get people who are going ahead and feel like, well, hey, you know, we've been on this roller coaster for a while and all we seem to do is go up. That, we need to go ahead and lock in some profit. And that's a natural occurrence. And, what we call that a consolidation move. People go ahead and lock in gains, and it's like the rungs on a ladder. That if we're able to go ahead and consolidate gains at a higher level, it's like putting another rung below our feet, something for us to stand on. Now if we go ahead and put our foot there and there's nothing there and we slip and fall and slide down the ladder a bit, that's called a correction. So right now we're just facing a little bit of consolidation and we'll see how things go. But, we've had a lot of good numbers that have come out from a fundamental perspective on the economy. Jobs numbers came out. Lily, you were talking about this earlier and how things were moving. I guess we added jobless claims were in the $200,000 or 200,000 claim mark instead of the 300,000. Do you have that number? I don't recall
right,
it.
Right, yes. Mm-hmm. They were expecting over 300,000, 305,000 in unemployment claim, but the number came out 289,000, but if you smooth it out, it's 293. So anyway, look at it, it's lower than what was forecast.
Yeah, well, if you take a look at trend lines, and the idea is that the longer-term average is at 293, but this most recent period was at 289. Is that what you said? Mm-hmm. Or was it 285?
289.
In any case, 289. Well, 289, lower than 293. So you can see the nearer-term trend is accelerating, that we're reducing the amount of jobless claims. Matter of fact, we're looking at about 9.9 million jobs having been added to payrolls over the last 53 months. And that's pretty darn good. We're averaging about 187,000 jobs a month over that period. Private employers added 198,000 jobs to payrolls in July. Government added another 11,000 that gave us about 209,000. Unemployment rate still sitting at about 6.2% right now. We have still about 9.7 million people unemployed. So not much changing through July. But even so, we see that the job market is picking up a bit. The question is, of course, what kind of jobs are we adding? Are we adding? We're not really, at least at this point in time, doesn't seem that we're adding, the real nice, larger jobs, the big jobs,
right,
the high paying jobs. We get to see, we're adding a bit more than the part time, I believe.
Right. Yeah. Well, earlier, remember how the housing market, it was disappointing, and you see all this headline, housing market falters amid rising rate, lower paying jobs. And so I guess what they're saying is, yeah, we have job gain, but they are low paying jobs.
Yeah. Well, we have, one of the lowest participations, of peak age workers. That we've seen in a very long time. I guess we went ahead and we hit up a high in the 90s, of the median, your bulk or your prime age, workers, the ones that are at the peak of their, career, earning the big bucks, as they like to say. But starting in the 2000s, I guess that began declining. And that the pace at which those were declining began to accelerate in about 2008, or essentially right after President Obama took office. Not that we're saying there's any correlation between the two, but maybe there is. In any case, we are seeing some significant issues with wages out there, and that's going to be something that we have to go ahead and address. But in the meantime, we take a look at some of the economy, at least at this point in time. We have our trade gap has kind of narrowed. We've gone ahead and we've seen a fairly steep decline in June numbers. more so than we expected. We're actually in the fastest contraction in that trade gap since November. The problem we're seeing, though, is that most of the decline here is from a lack of purchasing in imports. So it's not necessarily that we are going ahead and exporting more. We are importing less. And that's a question. We have to go ahead and see how that shakes itself out. It could mean that people are not as confident in the economy here going forward, and that the expected ramp up in consumer spending for the second half of the year may not actually materialize. One of those things that we're going to have to go ahead and pay close attention to. Now, given that we had a sharp increase in exports back in May and that held through June, you know, this is one of those ongoing stories that's going to go ahead and play out one way or the other. Now, let's make sure we go ahead and understand why we're taking a look at this. I mean, it always, I guess, behooves us to kind of take a step back and say, look, there's a reason that we're going ahead and evaluating these numbers. Part of it comes down to an allocation. When we're trying to figure out in our portfolios exactly what we're going to be doing and where we're going to be placing money, we need to know or at least have some idea as to where the economy is headed. If the United States economy is on track and it's going really well and the earnings we see from corporations are following in that track, then the United States is a great place to go ahead and put money. And that's one of the reasons that we want to evaluate that. If, on the other hand, we see that interest rates are higher and we're not getting much out of the way of equities, then we maybe want to over-allocate to fixed income. Or if neither one is moving and we seem to be kind of stagnant, but the developing world seems to be taking off, then maybe emerging markets seems to have a little bit more of an inclination. If we're in a rising inflationary environment, maybe we want to go ahead and skew our allocation towards commodities. So these are all these reasons from a top-down perspective. The first step in determining what we're going to do when we're investing is, how much do we have in cash? How much do we have in stocks? How much do we have in bonds? How much do we have in commodities? And where in the world do we put our money? And as you were saying, Lil, money doesn't go anywhere. It just gets moved around. Sort of like energy. You can't create it or destroy it, well, unless you're a government, and then you can tax it out of existence. But hey, in this particular case, you were saying that money wasn't going into mattresses, but where was it going? It was going someplace. It was going into emerging markets, right? I mean, isn't that where we have the net inflows in emerging markets, right?
Because I do track, you know, ETF fund flows.
Right.
You know, like we look at our market had gone down. Then I look at the emerging market that they actually have a nice inflow of, you know, cash going into emerging market. And I think I just saw the number with the S&P IQ because they're pretty accurate. They said that $4 billion went into emerging market just, you know, last month.
Well, interesting. Okay. Well, that's kind of us taking a look at the good news. It all isn't good news out there, though. We have some, bad news. Is there bad news? No. There's never bad news, right? There's only headwinds, difficulties, obstacles for us to overcome, things we need to work around.
Right.
Bad news is what you know, bad news is what you say after you've gone ahead and lost money.
Right. Yeah, I guess you can say that it is not a confident economy at this point, even though we see a lot of improving numbers, right?
Yeah, what else is new, though? It hasn't been a confident economy for the last 5 years and, what, 2 months, I guess, now, right?
Okay. Right. I get the point.
I mean, you know, isn't this the new normal? Shouldn't we be used to it by now?
Yeah, what happened to the 4% GDP growth as the normal? I guess we just no longer believe that we're going to grow anymore. We're going to be happy with just 2% growth.
We had a 4% GDP growth rate in the second quarter, and everybody said, whoa, look at that. What an aberration. There's no way we can keep that up. Anyway, look, there's a lot to talk about. We're going to have to go ahead and take a break here in a second. When we come back, though, we're going to take a look a little bit. There's some international conflicts that are out there. There's Fed policy, housing, and, of course, the question of interest rates and oil. Interesting stuff. I'm going to go ahead and check out a few of these things when we come back. You're listening to Money at Work on TalkZone.com. I'm Steve Memory. We'll talk to you again in just a few minutes.
Welcome back to Money at Work on Talk Zone. Here's Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
Welcome back. This is Steve Memory. I'm here with Lily Poy. Brian Bourdon is not with us. You're listening to Money at Work Radio on TalkZone.com. As always, you can go ahead and get in touch with us via email. Throw the email out here first. mail@moneyatworkradio.com. OV Capital, we are www.ovcapital.net. That's our website. We are a registered investment advisory firm registered in the state of Virginia and subject to all the rules and regulations of the Commonwealth of Virginia. 855, I always do that, 855-691-8800 is the phone number if you want to go ahead and get in touch with us, 855-691-8800. Lily, we're back again. Wanted to talk about a few things. As we were mentioning beforehand, we have some interesting things going on. What is that? That's the old Chinese curse, isn't that? May you live in interesting times?
Interesting time. We always live in interesting time.
Well, today's interesting times involve things like Russia and the Ukraine going at it. There's a tit for tat happening out there with Russia responding to sanctions by going ahead and not allowing anybody to buy anything. Or I don't, what did they say? I don't, they're going to go ahead and take their ball and go home, I think. You know, right now we're looking at a situation where the imports from Russian firms falling by about 10%. Here in the U.S., we have, for the third consecutive month, decline in U.S. purchases. We have an asymmetric gap between buying and selling now in the trade gap with Russia. It's up about 25%. The International Monetary Fund is out there right now, and they say that things could translate into about $100 billion of capital fleeing Russia thus far this year. That's fairly significant for them. For us, we don't really care so much. I think somebody once said that the impact of Russia on our economy is roughly that of the state of Rhode Island. Now, I don't know if that in fact is true, but it was an interesting comment. The fact is that it doesn't make up that much of what we do here. It does, however, impact the EU. And much of the reason it impacts the EU is dealing with oil and other services that that the EU uses. There's a lot of agriculture still being purchased, a lot of trade that's done through Europe that comes from Russia, and in fact the USSR, the old Soviet Union satellite states, and Russia combined together with OPEC account for about 90% of all of the supply growth of oil through 2010. You know, everybody may know that oil is probably the single largest commodity coming out of Russia at this point in time. And it's an energy economy, folks. Countries go ahead and run on it. Corporations run on it. We need to have it, and Russia has it. So while we may not have to worry too much here, it is a big concern over in Europe, and one of those things that that we're going to go ahead and see. Now, Europe is sitting on a rather stagnant economy at this point in time, and a matter of fact, Italy's just moved back into a recessionary environment. So there's some concerns about whether there's a relapse in the European Union. Whether in fact they head towards deflation, and much of that is what we've been talking about in the EU about a lot of the economic moves that have been done. Now the ECB just came out and they said we're going to stand back. They had their version of quantitative easing occur this past month. So this month when they all met, they said, hey, look, we want to go ahead and see if this has an impact first. They haven't necessarily gone ahead and been as proactive in moving things, but Europe is some place to go ahead and watch, folks. At this point in time, valuations in Europe are pretty cheap. If they can go ahead and manage to weather storms and re-stimulate the economy over there, the EU might be a place going forward to look for opportunities as far as investing is concerned. Interesting thing. We were talking about oil here. I mentioned it just a second ago. And as I said, OPEC and the former USSR accounts for about 90% of the growth of supply through 2010. That doesn't take into account the most recent efforts in the United States here. And we have been coming on strong as an oil producer. Even so, there is a certain amount of international oil to be if we're taking a look at the total supply, we are losing some of the productivity out of the North Sea and Mexico. And the combined efforts of Brazil, U.S., and Canada may not necessarily be enough to offset those losses. Now, the developed nations have essentially, since 2000, reined in their consumption of oil. We're down about 5.5% since 2000. On the other hand, the developing countries that are out there, particularly China, have driven their consumption up by about 50%. Now, when you're a developed nation, you're not likely to go ahead and make significant cuts in your consumption or your energy use. It's just not there. Right now, we are an energy economy. So when we take a look at oil and energy resources that are out there, we have to go ahead and pay attention to the fact that economies like China and other industrializing nations are going to be increasing their capacity and increasing their use of energy. And that means at this particular point in time in world history, that means oil, folks. So we definitely need to go ahead and pay attention to oil. Right now, it's one of the things we've been saying over the past couple of weeks is that oil and energy are favorable places to go ahead and look for long-term investing. Now, I know a lot of people are going to go ahead and sit there and say, well, gee, you take a look at oil prices over the last few days. What have they done? Okay. That's right. They've gone down. They went down, about 2.7%. Mm-hmm. Since the 29th of July, right?
Right. You know, the last time we talked, it was $103 per barrel, and now right. It's actually about, what, $97?
Yeah, cracked that $100 area.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the interesting thing, you know, when you go ahead and you want to evaluate why in the world is this happening, there was an article that came out in the Wall Street Journal back on August 4th. It was written by Nicole Friedman. Want to make sure she goes ahead and gets credit for this, because I'm going to quote from her fairly liberally here. She speaks about the Coffeyville, Kansas refinery. And it's a refinery that processes just 115,000 barrels a day of oil. It's not even what you would call one of the top 50 refineries as far as size is concerned in the U.S. Okay. But on the 29th, it was shut down by a fire. Ever since then, we've seen the price of oil having bottomed out. We're hovering about near 6-month lows, okay? And that overshadows a lot of what's gone on here with the difficulties in Iraq, difficulties in the Middle East with Israel and Gaza, difficulties in the Ukraine with Russia. All of that has been overshadowed essentially by this small refinery having been shut down by fire. You say, how in the world can this occur? Well, the refinery is essentially out of action for 4 weeks, which means it does not draw crude oil from a key storage hub in Cushing, Oklahoma. Now, the reason that that's important is because Cushing helps set the benchmark for the U.S. oil price on the NYMEX. And when you go ahead and you have one of these key benchmark areas showing a lack of drawdown, if you will, on that for about 115,000 barrel a day mark, what you find is a significant reduction in the demand at the Cushing hub. And that demand drop is enough to have gone ahead and help suppress prices at this point in time.
So you're saying that, Steve, that oil prices should go up higher than 97 in current economic condition?
I'm saying if you take a look at what's going on in the world, you take a look at what's going on out there in the Middle East, that oil from this point in time looks like an excellent opportunity.
Hmm.
Now, we'll have to go ahead and evaluate that a little bit when we come back. Because it looks, well, actually, oops, sorry, got my times wrong here. We have a little bit of time. We can go ahead and take a look at something. We've been mentioning ways to go ahead and kind of take a play on oil. And one of the ones we like is using the exchange traded fund GSG. This is an iShare, the S&P GSCI Commodity Index Trust. They're sort of a mid-cap growth orientation. They have the most energy sector exposure of any broad basket commodity fund. About 70% of the assets in GSG are linked to oil, natural gas, and gasoline. Okay, the expense ratio for this is fairly inexpensive at about 75 basis points. That's 0.75%. Now, the ETF is actually down about 1.34% or so year to date, and it's actually at about 93% on the oversold side of the 10-week trading band, middle of the trading band at 33. And when I looked earlier, they were trading about 31. And where else?
31.79 right now. Yeah, I looked at it, you know, like in the past year, you know, 52 weeks backward. It's a pretty tight range, you know, between $30.60 to $34.33.
Right. Well, if you're picking something up at about $31, you figure 31.5 is major support in the bottom of the trading range, and you get a move up to 34, that's a 10% move, essentially, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a tight trading band. But you also have very low downside, in my particular opinion, given the support level at about 31.5, with a fair amount of upside. So when we take a look at a particular way to go ahead and play energy, this is it. But we've had a circumstance where we're seeing, you know, look, the CPI index came out. Okay, that's the consumer price index, and that was up about 2.1% through the end of June. Okay, we're looking for data coming out on August 19th from the CPI. But right now, that's the latest data we have. We're seeing some inflation in the marketplace. We're going to see some inflation in the commodities. And oil, I believe, like I say, it's an energy economy, long-term play. I think this is a decent entry point for oil and oil-related services. The other one to go ahead and take a look at, OIH. Currently trading in the 50s, $53 or so. We'll have to go ahead and come back. We can take a look at that and wrap that up because now we're facing our hard break. So let me just remind you that you are listening to Money at Work on TalkZone.com. My name is Steve Memory. I'm here with Lily Poy. Again, if you have any questions, feel free to go ahead and get in touch with us at 855-691-8800. We'll speak with you again in just a couple of minutes.
And now, more of Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Here's Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
Good afternoon and welcome back. This is Steve Memory. I'm here with Lily Poy. You're listening to Money at Work Radio. Unfortunately, Brian Bourdon cannot be with us. He's had a previous engagement that has taken him out of the area. As I mentioned before the break, you can get in touch with us by calling toll-free 855-691-8800. You can get us an email at mail@moneyatworkradio.com. Check us out on the web, www.ovcapital.net. Lily, before we hit that break, we were talking about oil and the possibility of it being sold off at to a point where it represents a decent value for a long-term buy. We mentioned GSG.
And you also talked about OIH, which is the Market Vectors Oil Services ETF.
Exactly. That's what I was going to go ahead and have you discuss a little bit about the OIH. It's a kind of a large group orientation on that. Now, as you mentioned beforehand, it's a holder, right? So what does that mean for folks?
That means that you have to buy 100 shares, you know, instead of like maybe buy, you know, ETFs, just like a stock, you know, you don't have to buy a round lot. But if I remember correctly for this one, you might have to buy 100 shares. But
absolutely. Yeah.
Right. So this investment, they replicate as closely as possible before fees and expenses, the price and yield performance of the market vector. You know, that's the index.
Right.
The U.S. listed oil services, 25 index.
Yeah.
So they normally invest at least 80% of its total asset in securities that comprise of the fund's benchmark index. And
Those include the behemoths like Halliburton and Schlumberger, mm-hmm. etc.
Yeah, let me tell you some of the big companies that is in it. It's a Schlumberger, Halliburton, National Oil Vago, Cameron International Group, and Baker Hughes.
Yeah, what they do is they actually go ahead. They go out there and they find the 50 largest companies by capitalization, and they take the top 25. So it's all about size. This is the 80, you know, the 800 pound gorilla in the market fund, if you will. But interestingly enough, we take a look at it. We're trading at about $53 a share. They're up 11% or so on a year-to-date basis. But from a technical perspective, just slightly on the oversold side of everything. We're about 51% onto the oversold side of the 10-week trading band. Middle of the trading band at $55.66. Bottom of the trading band at $51 with major support at $49. So there's a little way to go. If you want to wait for a little more of a pullback on there, that's not a bad idea. Expense ratio on this, surprisingly enough, very, very low at 35 basis points or 0.35%.
That is pretty low. And they even give you a dividend.
Yeah, they do. The dividend is sitting there in the 1% range at this point in time, I think, right?
Yep.
What are we looking at? About 1.01. Yeah, not too bad, not too far off. But part of what we're looking, look, despite the whole idea, first of all, that energy is what drives the global economy, and as the economies ramp up, energy usage is going to ramp up as well. We are, as I mentioned, looking at an increase in the consumer price index. We take a look at where we were. We were at about an annualized rate of at 1.5% in March. For the 12 months ending in June, CPI was up 1.9, and that was up from 1.8 in April. So our mid-July was up to 2.1. You can see that it looks as if we're going ahead and we're seeing inflation start to show up. Now, this has a twofold impact for us. One, it does presage the idea that we'll see some rise in commodity prices, particularly in oil and in other areas. It also has gone ahead and given impetus for this most recent pullback. When we take a look at the idea that the Fed may be pressed into raising rates sooner than everybody expected. Okay, well, right now we're looking at the end of quantitative easing come October. And the earliest estimates for an increase in the Fed rate was probably April of 2015. Mm-hmm. But we've had, at this point, we've got stronger than expected earnings in corporate earnings. We've seen consumer confidence at least reported as being stronger than expected. Existing home sales have come in decently. Leading indicators have come in pretty well. And now a sharper than expected rise in inflation. And all of these things suggest to some folks that the Fed is going to be put in a position where it needs to raise rates sooner rather than later. And much of the concern of this is that it will end up meaning that we're going to have to be seeing money moved out of the stock market. Right now, the stock market is the only game in town. You're not getting anything out of bonds. You're not getting anything from most fixed income positions. If you, certainly aren't being paid to hold anything in cash. So the stock market has been the only game, and that's been where the money is going. Look, the Fed has kept up an easy money policy for some time. That money goes somewhere, and where it's gone to this particular point in time has been the stock market, and actually will likely go ahead and continue through the remainder of this year. We're still expecting that we won't see any Fed increase until about the second quarter of 2015. Probably April or so. And I think that's about where things will likely shake out. And it does mean that we'll likely go ahead and see a nice rate of return for the remainder of this year. But for the economy, it also has a separate impact. And Lily, you and I were speaking about this earlier. Home prices had been on a bit of a tear.
Right. For the median price, for an existing home, you know, they had a gain of about, what, 11.5% last year?
Yeah.
That's second only to the 2005's 12% increase, the highest on record. Now, that's according to the National Association of Realtors. Now, this year, you know, they are saying that the price would appreciate slowly to 5.6%.
That's more near an historic level.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like that for the year ended in June, we were up about 7.5% on prices.
Mm-hmm.
That was a revised number, okay, because beforehand we had about an 8.3% year over year. That was in May. You know, that was originally reported as 8.8 and then revised down to 8.3 for May. So June was 7.5% in a year over year. Is that correct? Am I reading that right? Prices were up year for the year ended in June. But we were looking at about 11.4% on a year over year basis, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
What we've done though is we've hit a bit of a break, if you will, right? There's been a bit of a drop off here in the last recently. I think that's what we're reporting. We're down from that 11.5% or 11.4% down to that 7.4.
Mm-hmm. Right. Actually, there are two factors that contributed to this slowing in the housing numbers. You know, you have mm-hmm. rising mortgage rate, right? Last year we see about 3.5%.
Yeah.
And this year the mortgage would be hovering between 4.25%, 2.5%. So, you know, a lot of people, you know, were saying that, oh, you know, maybe the rate will go down. I'm just going to wait. And in the meantime, house prices actually had gone up.
Yeah.
And until, you know, some of the sellers in the market lower, you know, they were able to sell it last year, you know, at a higher price.
Yeah.
But this year, you know, they probably would have to lower their asking price in order to sell the property.
Yeah. Part of the reason we have to worry about that with the higher interest rate coming out there, it means it makes the cost of ownership more expensive. So what you could afford when interest rates were in the threes is not necessarily what you can afford when interest rates are in the fours. You know, that's a substantial difference.
Well, and I think what happened to a lot of people, when interest rate goes mm-hmm. down, they'll raise the principal price. But they're just kind of like offset each other, don't you think? You know,
well,
you raise the price
is,
when interest rate is low, then you lower the price when interest rate is higher.
Yeah, but you still have a situation where people have gone ahead and made purchases of homes. And if those purchases were at higher levels mm-hmm. and interest rates go up, meaning that the cost of buying that house is higher, that means that the value of your home has to be lower to sell to the same people. And the reason it has to be lower is because median family incomes haven't increased. They've actually decreased, which means that there's less money available in a household income to go ahead and pay for that mortgage. And this is, I think, one of those areas that we're going to go ahead and see maybe some significant issues. The question of whether or not we have the ability to go ahead and improve family incomes. You know, we've been focusing on jobs here for so long that we think a job is a job is a job, but it isn't necessarily. If we're not getting the higher wages out of these jobs, if these jobs aren't the same level of the jobs that were lost, what we're having is essentially we have excess productivity capacity in the workforce that is being underutilized and undercompensated. So if we don't have the same incomes coming into households, even though they may have jobs, they still can't afford housing prices.
Because they don't have good jobs that pay, right?
Exactly. And if those people who have inventory for sale can't get the prices that they're looking for, they're likely not to sell. I mean, assuming, of course, they are not forced into a circumstance to sell. You know, so you have a certain amount of, what is it, elasticity or inelasticity of supply? Which way is it? I don't recall. But anyway, this is one of the big headwinds on the economy. And one of those areas that we're going to have to take a real good close look at going forward. The question of whether or not we have a circumstance in our economy that is essentially a sea anchor acting on the economy called the U.S. housing industry. right now, I guess what we're looking at is that you know, we're seeing a decline in labor force participation. And as I mentioned, I think beforehand that, you know, the prime age for, prime age workers, have declined and declined somewhat dramatically. And the question is whether this is becoming as a result of people just retiring. We think it's probably a bit more than that. We're probably looking at a circumstance where there's significant frustration with the economy, having been in such a circumstance for so long that really we're underemploying people.
Yeah, because I was just looking at the Census Bureau. You know, they were saying that the recession, you know, had prevented a good portion of the millennial generation from reaching a point where they can buy a home. So, you know, as a result, we are seeing like a subdued household formation, because you really want to have household formation. That's, you know, that would be good for the housing market.
Sure, right. Well, it's the American dream, right? Everybody wants to be able to go ahead and own a home. Well, here's the sad statistic for the day. nearly one in six jobs in the U.S. are working for the government, more than any single private industry out there. That's a depressing thought. Mm-hmm. Well, it looks like we're coming up on another break here. We're going to go ahead and take just a short moment here, and we'll be back in about 2 minutes. I'm Steve Memory. I'm with Lily Boy. Brian Bourdon not available, but I'm talking for him as well. This is Money at Work Radio. We'll go ahead and see you in about 2 minutes.
You're listening to Money at Work on TalkZone.com. Back to Brian Bourdon and Steve Memory.
Welcome back. My name's Steve Memory. Welcome back to the final segment here of Money at Work. We are with you here on August. What is it? I guess it's the 7th now, isn't it? Man, 7th. I tell you, time flies.
Thursday.
Look at that. I know. Amazing. I tell you what, Lil, we were talking on the break here, and kind of wanted to go ahead and jump into that because we don't have a whole lot of time coming up in this final hour. But wanted to wrap up housing there. But you had an interesting comment that you were saying about from census data.
Right. Well, actually, you know, they're saying that there are potential buyers out there. You know, you're looking at the housing supply is at a 15-year low relative to potential buyers. And when they say potential buyers, that means that it is the percentage of working age population. So the average is 1.31. So now it's 0.91. So supply is like getting lower and lower. So why is it that demand is not there? Right.
Well, yeah, the interesting
demand
thing,
is that they just couldn't do it.
Right. Well, you got it. Like I said, the interesting thing, of course, is that, it was housing that got us into this whole financial Armageddon situation. It was the easy lending and the development that went with that easy lending. And a significant run up in price. So normally in a regular recessionary environment, you'd be sitting there saying, well, we have a reversion to the mean effect occurring. That is essentially, look, if you ended up getting, 10% for a few years and the average rate of return is about 5%, more than likely we have to go ahead and underperform for a few years to get back to the normal trend line. Okay. The problem that we're seeing is a compounding effect in housing prices. And that is not just, hey, let's go ahead and wait till the normal, average, increase in home prices would be, you know, equal to where we are now. What we're looking at is a circumstance that, you had a significantly higher number of people in the marketplace buying beforehand, a certain amount of overdevelopment that occurred, much more stringent credit and lending requirements coming out of banks, okay? And all of this conspires to make it more difficult for people to go ahead and buy houses, okay?
And at the beginning, remember, we thought housing is going to be really improving, but don't forget, earlier, there were a lot of foreigners, you know, buying up real estate in the U.S. And there's actually a report that talks about the foreign buyers.
Yeah.
And they said that Chinese national are the leading foreign buyers of the U.S. real estate. They account for $22 billion in sales. or 24% of the total U.S. home
was
purchased by overseas buyers. So if that group is not buying anymore.
Yeah. Hey, look, there's a significant amount of work that remains to be done. And here we are, you know, how many years later? 6 years after?
6 years later. Mm-hmm.
You know, and we're still going ahead and having to work through this. It took us a while to go ahead. It's like they used to say about weight. It takes you a while to put weight on. It takes you a while to go ahead and take it back off again. And this is the same kind of thing that we're going through in the housing environment.
Yeah. And actually,
I was going to say, we're in our final quarter here. We only have a couple of minutes left. I wanted to go ahead and just kind of review a couple of positions. Normally we don't go ahead and do this, but I think I'm going to jump into it anyway. Here's an interesting opportunity. It's not necessarily what we would call a buy, but it is a trade. Symbol is HEES, that is H&E Equipment Services. They are a small cap value stock trading on the NASDAQ. Dividend yield on the stock is about 2.7% or so, currently trading around $37. They have a beta of 1.9. So this is for your very aggressive investors who are looking for a maybe a short-termer trade, but at least something to go ahead and take a look at. The company rents, sells, and provides parts and services for construction and industrial equipment. Okay. Essentially, they work with aerial platforms, cranes, earth moving equipment, and industrial lifts. And they're mostly in the west and southwest regions. The U.S. construction market, the industrial equipment market, is highly fragmented. Usually there's a lot of small, independently owned businesses, and they serve local markets. And there's a small number of national operators. Construction equipment is largely distributed to end users through either rental arrangements or equipment dealers. Okay, most of the industry focuses on one channel of distribution. HEES, that is H&E Equipment Services, operates in both. So they have their equipment rentals under United Rentals, Hertz Equipment Rental, and Rental Service Corp. And they have the equipment dealers that include Finning and Toromont. The company essentially has a one-stop shop kind of focus here. They want to be the primary categories for heavy equipment and industrial equipment. And they have sort of a cradle-through-grave approach, the ability to go ahead and service that industry in a holistic fashion. What this means is it's kind of proven to be a relatively stable, high-margin revenue source for them. If you take a look at where their earnings are, since the same quarter 1 year prior, revenues have risen by 11.7%. They've increased bottom line earnings by $1.26 versus the 83 cents in the prior year. This year we're expecting improvements in earnings. We're looking for $1.49 versus $1.26. Net income has increased by 55.7%, particularly when you compare it to the quarter 1 year prior. We're up from $4.78 million to $7.44 million. Now, on a price-to-earnings basis, they're trading at a premium, $27.20 versus peers $23.30. Price-to-projected earnings, $18.55 to $18.65, so you can see fairly in line there. Price-to-book, a hefty 12.36 versus peers of $3.89. This is where they start to look interesting. The price-to-earnings growth, $1.49 versus the peers at $2.26. They have earnings growth of 54.65 on the metric as opposed to a peers at 27.84. And their price-to-sales is at 1.26, almost half the peers' 2.2. So this is an interesting opportunity. They're trading at about 1% on the oversold of their 10-week trading band. Okay, middle of the trading band at 36.85. But they have triple bottom support at 36. From a technical perspective, that's pretty darn good and not that far away. Major support again at 34. So for an aggressive trade, buying this particular stock in this area, if you can get it below 36, congratulations. But with a stop loss at 34 and a price target of 45, that combination giving you some downside risk at of about $2 a share with an upside target of close to $10 a share, I think is a pretty darn interesting trade for those who are aggressively minded. Now, we've been talking about the possibility of going ahead and having pullbacks. I wanted to take a look at Aetna right now. This is a large cap value stock. The symbol on Aetna is AET. They trade on the New York Stock Exchange. Dividend yield of about 1.15%. 52-week high, 85.72 versus a low of 60.32. They offer a broad range of traditional voluntary and consumer-directed health insurance products and related services. Most folks know who Aetna is. We're looking for operating revenue to grow by about 19.5% in 2014. They bolstered their ability to go ahead and do this by the acquisition of Coventry Healthcare. We're seeing healthy enrollment in the Medicare Advantage, but particularly AET, Aetna, has the scale, diversity, and cash flow reinforced by the acquisition of Coventry to be able to go ahead and perform better than most of the other insurers that are out there. They have a number of cost control initiatives that are out there, including the penetration of accountable care organizations that will go ahead and really be accretive to the bottom line. Aetna's revenue growth has slightly outpaced the industry. They came in with revenues increased by about 25.8%, which is just ahead of industry's 21.2%. Now, when we take a look at the price of earnings, they're at $13.55, substantial discount to the peers of $28.53. Price to projected earnings at $10.87 versus peers of $20.11. Price to earnings growth a paltry 59 cents versus the peers' price of $55.76. That's pretty darn good. We go ahead and the price to book is $1.87 versus the $3.06 out there for the industry peers. Price to sales at 50 cents versus 75 cents. Sales growth at 37.10 versus the peer sales growth of 10.92. And the price to cash flow, $7.30 versus peers 15.44. So all that being said, Aetna trading on a substantial discount against other areas in the industry. That being said, they are trading fairly high on their own metrics. There's recently been a significant pullback in Aetna. AET is trading about 36% on the oversold of their 10-week trading band. Middle of the trading band at $81.18, and the bottom of the trading range is at $73. We have double bottom support at $70. So I believe we were saying they were down a bit here today, trading at in the 70s. They're down about 2 points from where they were yesterday.
And it's a 75.38. Right,
yes, 75.36. Okay. So we are buyers of OB Capital, of AET and OB Capital. If they can consolidate around 73 and we can get a price entry point below $76, we have a price dollar target of $98 on this stock. And this is a good long-term buying opportunity if they can consolidate. AET is owned in portfolios at OB Capital. HEES is not owned in portfolios at OB Capital. That's about all the time we have for today here. Lily, thank you very much for coming in. Those of you out there, thanks for listening. My name is Steve Memory. For Brian Bourdon, Lily Poy, you've been listening to Money at Work on TalkZone.com. We'll see you next week.